read by Howard Philpott. We continue Long Walk to Freedom, Nelson Mandela's autobiography, in a couple of minutes. But first, the weather, and Thomas Schaffernacker's here. Hello there.
Hi there, Mairead. Very, very mild last 24 hours. In fact, 15.5 degrees was the warmest place in Scotland in Achnacart. Not quite a record, but not far off. It was also the wettest place, 32 millimetres of rain. And the sunniest place was actually Wattisham, only 1.5 hours of sunshine. So tonight, mild and damp, if not wet, across most parts of the country. Temperatures no lower than around 10 or 12 degrees across Western Britain, from Plymouth to Belfast to Stornoway. In London, a little cooler here, temperatures of around 6 or 7 degrees. So let's get on with the forecast for Friday itself. And we're going to start, first of all, with Northern Ireland. Here, it's going to be a rainy morning. The mid-morning should be a little bit brighter, but then in the afternoon, we're going to see sunshine and showers, around 10 degrees here. Now onto Scotland. The western half of Scotland will have a wet morning, followed by a showery and breezy afternoon, 10 degrees expected in Glasgow. The eastern half of Scotland, there will be some rain on and off through the day, but I think most of the day in eastern Scotland will be dry, 10 degrees expected in Aberdeen. On to England then. Overall, a cloudy day for most of us across England. There will be some rain on and off through the course of the day, heaviest of which will occur across southwestern England, Wales and the Midlands. But as I say, almost anywhere at any time, there will be some rain around. Temperatures will range anywhere between 9 and 12 degrees, so also quite a mild day across England and Wales on Friday. And then an outlook, quite an important one here, to Saturday. It's going to turn stormy across Northern Ireland and in particular Western Scotland, also the Irish Sea coasts. We've had gales with rain, gusts in fact in some spots 60 to 70 miles an hour, and if anything it'll get even stormier as we head into Sunday night across the northwest of England, Scotland that is. Back to you.
Thanks, Thomas. Thomas Schaffernacker there at the BBC Weather Centre. This week, we present Long Walk to Freedom, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela, as our book of the week. In 1959, the leaders of the African National Congress, the ANC, were put on trial for treason. It was decided by the leadership, including the 43-year-old Mr. Mandela, that if they won, he would work as a secret organiser for the party. In March 1961, they were found not guilty, and immediately Mr. Mandela went underground. The reader is the South African actor, John Carney.
The key to being underground is to be invisible. My most frequent disguise was that of a chauffeur or a garden boy. The pose of chauffeur was convenient because I could travel under the pretext of driving my master's car. During those early months, my outlaw existence caught the imagination of the press. I was dubbed the Black Pimpernel. I moved through the townships in different parts of the country, attending secret meetings at night. I would pop up here and there to the annoyance of the police and to the delight of the people. I at first discussed the armed struggle as far back as 1952 with Walter Sisulu. The lesson I took away from the Defiance campaign was that in the end, we had no alternative to armed and violent resistance. Over and over again, we had used all the non-violent weapons in our arsenal, all to no avail. For whatever we did was met with an iron hand. Now, I again conferred with Walter, and we agreed that the organization had to set out a new course. We decided that I should raise the issue of armed struggle within the working committee of the ANC, and I did so in June 1961. We argued the entire night, but towards dawn, there was a resolution. The Congress authorized me to go ahead and form a new military organization separate from the ANC. I, who had never been a soldier, had been given the task of starting an army. The name of this new organization was Umkhonto weSizwe, the Spear of the Nation, or MK for short. I began the only way I knew how, by reading and talking to experts. I read the works of Che Guevara, Mao Zedong, Fidel Castro. I studied our history both before and after the white men. I wanted to find the fundamental principles for starting a revolution. Guerrilla warfare was a possibility, but since the ANC had been reluctant to embrace violence, it made sense to start with a form of violence that did the least harm against individuals, sabotage. One warm December afternoon, I heard on the radio that Chief Luthuli had been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo. The award was an affront to the nationalists. The day after Luthuli returned from Oslo, homemade bombs exploded at electric power stations and government offices in Johannesburg, Port Elizabeth, and Durban. The explosions took the government by surprise and shocked white South Africans with the realization that they were sitting on top of a volcano. My sanctuary during much of my time underground was Lily's Leaf Farm, located in Rivonia, a northern suburb of Johannesburg. The farmhouse and property had been purchased by the movement for the purpose of having a safe house for those underground. I moved in under the pretext that I was the caretaker and would look after the place until my master took possession. I had taken the alias David Mutsamai, the name of one of my former clients. In December 1961, the ANC received an invitation from the Pan-African Freedom Movement to attend its conference in Addis Ababa in February 1962. I was asked to lead the ANC delegation to the conference and to arrange political and economic support for a new military force. I spent the night before my departure with Winnie at the house of white friends. She was anxious about my leaving the country, and once again remained stoic. She behaved as much like a soldier as a wife. The conference was officially opened by our host, the Emperor, and for the first time in many months, I flung aside the identity of David Mutsamai and became Nelson Mandela. I flew to Lobatse on the South African border. I was to drive back to South Africa with Cecil Williams, a white theater director and a member of MK. Posing as his chauffeur, I got behind the wheel and we left that night for Johannesburg. The highway runs parallel to the railway line for a great distance. I went from contemplating the natural beauty to ruminating on the fact that the railway line, being so close to the highway, offered a convenient place for sabotage. I was almost too engrossed to notice a Ford V8 filled with white men shoot past us on the right. I instinctively turned round to look behind, and I saw two more cars filled with white men. Suddenly, in front of us, the Ford was signaling us to stop. I knew in that instant that my life on the run was over. When our car stopped, a tall, slender man with a stern expression on his face came directly over to the window on the passenger side. In a calm voice, he introduced himself as Sergeant Foster and produced an arrest warrant. He asked me to identify myself, and I told him my name was Mutsamai. He seemed a bit irritated, and then he said, "Ach, your name is Nelson Mandela, and this is Cecil Williams, and you are under arrest." The next day, I was taken to Johannesburg and I appeared in court for formal remand. I listened silently to the charges of inciting African workers to strike and leaving the country without valid travel documents. In apartheid South Africa, the penalties for these could be as much as 10 years in prison. Yet the charges were something of a relief. Clearly, the state did not have enough evidence to charge me under the far more serious crime of treason or sabotage. As I was leaving the courtroom, I saw Winnie in the spectators' gallery. She looked distressed and gloomy. All I could do, as I descended the steps to the basement, was to give her a smile, as if to show her that I was not worried and she must not be either. I cannot imagine that it helped very much. The initial hearing was set for Monday, October 15, 1962, in the Old Synagogue. During the trial, the prosecutor called more than 100 witnesses. Most of them gave evidence to show that I left the country illegally and that I had incited African workers to strike. I did not dispute that I was technically guilty of both charges. When the state finally concluded its case, I rose and declared that I was not calling any witnesses at all. My plea in mitigation lasted over an hour. It was not a judicial appeal, but a political statement. Whatever sentence your worship sees fit to impose upon me, for the crime for which I am convicted, I said, may the court rest assured that when my sentence had been completed, I will still be moved by my conscience. I have no doubt that posterity will pronounce that I was innocent and that the criminals who should have been brought before this court are the government. When I had finished my plea in mitigation, in a courtroom heavy with tension, the magistrate pronounced the sentence. 3 years for inciting people to strike, and 2 years for leaving the country without a passport. 5 years in all, with no possibility of parole. As the court rose, I turned to the gallery and made a clenched fist. For the next few weeks, I was locked up for 23 hours a day, with 30 minutes exercise in the morning and afternoon. I had nothing to read, nothing to write on or with, no one to talk to. I soon began to protest against my circumstances and demanded to be put with other political prisoners. My request was ultimately granted. One morning in July 1963, as I was walking along the passage to my cell, I saw the man who had been foreman at Lily's Leaf Farm, the underground safe house. His presence could only mean one thing, that the authorities had discovered Rivonia. In one fell swoop, the police had indeed captured the entire high command of Umkhonto. The raid was a coup for the state. We were all charged with sabotage. On our first day in court, we were allowed to meet with some of the counsel who were acting for us, including Bram Fischer. Bram was very somber. In a quiet voice, he told us that this was an extremely serious trial and that the state had formally advised him that they would ask for the supreme penalty permitted by the law, the death sentence. From that moment on, we lived under the shadow of the gallows. In my own case, the court had sufficient evidence for conviction. Documents in my own handwriting told that I had left the country illegally, had arranged for military training for our men, and had been behind the formation of Umkhonto. I would be the first witness and therefore set the tone for the defense. We decided that instead of giving testimony, I would read the statement from the dock. On Monday, April the 20th, 1964, under the tightest security, we were taken to the Palace of Justice to begin our defense. Bram said, "The defense case, my lord, will commence with a statement from the dock by accused number one." I faced the courtroom and read slowly. I wanted to impress upon the court that we had not acted irresponsibly. I laid particular emphasis on our resolve to cause no harm to human life. The lack of human dignity experienced by Africans is a direct result of the policy of white supremacy. White supremacy implies black inferiority. Legislation decides white supremacy and entrenches this notion. Africans want security and a stake in society. Above all, we want equal political rights because without them, our disabilities will be permanent. I had been reading my speech, and at this point, I placed my papers on the defense table and turned to face the judge, as I spoke from memory the final words. During my lifetime, I have dedicated myself to the struggle of the African people. I have fought against white domination. I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony with equal opportunities. It is an ideal I hope to live for, and if needs be, an ideal for which I am prepared to die. The silence in the courtroom was now complete. I had read for over 4 hours. On Friday, June 12, 1964, we entered the court for the last time. The spectators' gallery was full. Judge DeVette nodded for us to rise. He said, "The crime of which the accused have been convicted is in essence one of high treason. The state has decided not to charge the crime in this form. Bearing this in mind, we have decided not to impose the supreme penalty, which in a case like this would usually be proper. The sentence in the case of all the accused will be one of life imprisonment." There was a great collective gasp in the courtroom. I turned and smiled to the gallery, searching out Winnie and my mother. I flashed a thumbs-up ANC salute, and the police began to hustle us out of the dock towards the door. I looked again for Winnie's face. I was not able to see her before I got through the doors and into the cells below.
Long Walk to Freedom, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela, was read by the South African actor John Carney, abridged by Micheline Wonder and produced by Chris Wallace. It was a Watershed production for BBC Radio 4. On Sunday morning, John Humphreys will present a special programme to mark the funeral of Nelson Mandela. The service will take place in his home village of Kunu in Eastern Cape Province, where the Tembu community will conduct a traditional ceremony. And John Humphreys will be there live from South Africa from 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. And that's in place of Broadcasting House.